Don't be afraid of the dark. Just relax and let the darkness fall over you.
Welcome to Afraidish, a podcast where every four episodes we venture into a new state and take a deep dive into the history and paranormal while enjoying some tasty adult beverages. From ghost sightings to hauntings, urban legends and cryptids, let's get weird and afraid-ish together. I'm Paul.
Hi, and I'm Ashley.
And this is going to be a bonus episode, episode one for Missouri.
Yay! So,
I decided to start doing bonus episodes after each state, so
cool.
And I hope if anyone visited ST's tannery, they made it out alive and they were not made into a pair of freckled shoes.
I just received a pair in the mail yesterday.
Wonder who that could be. So I listened to my podcast over again, and well, I could tell you I went a little crazy on the editing. I used to think I had to edit all the slight pauses and stuff. Now I know most of the time it's needed and sounds better with the pauses instead of having no pauses and everything being connected. I did listen to all of them.
Jump cuts are great for like video.
Yeah.
Not so much for audio. Sometimes, especially me, I use pauses for dramatic effect. Same way that I use swear words to spice up my sentences.
Yeah. So I'm going to work on that. I got new mics and still working on the audio with those. It might sound a little different.
Yeah, but hopefully they actually work.
Yeah.
So, I mean, anything's better than nothing.
Yeah. At least I don't have to worry about that mixer anymore. Yeah. All right, so this episode is basically going to be about extra stuff for Missouri and to recap all the other episodes.
Okay.
So let's get started with something we didn't do for the Missouri episodes, and that's fun facts about the Show Me State.
Yay!
Number one, human settlement has been recorded in the region for at least 12,000 years.
Sweet.
Number two, the Missouri Territory was admitted to the Union on August 10th, 1821, making it the 24th state. Missouri's 200th birthday was yesterday.
Happy birthday. And I do apologize for our dog. He cannot be controlled. He is a part of this family. He will not be silenced.
Anyways. Number three. The name Show Me State came from when Missouri Congressman Willard Duncan Vandiver, in an 1899 speech in Philadelphia, said, "For thy eloquence neither convinces nor satisfy me. I am from Missouri. You have got to show me." So that's where the Show Me State came from.
Wow.
Number four, Missouri is named after the Missouri River, which was named after the indigenous Missouri Indians. The Missouri River is the longest river in the USA.
I didn't know that.
Yep.
I thought the Mississippi was.
No.
Oh.
It's not.
The more you know.
The more you know. Anyways, number five, ice cream cones made from waffles were first invented in Missouri at the St. Louis World's Fair in 1904 when an ice cream vendor ran out of cups to supply the ice cream. The vendor asked a waffle vendor to roll waffles to supply the ice cream, and hence the birth of the cone took place.
Wow.
Number six, Missouri has the country's tallest monument, the Gateway Arch in St. Louis. It is 630 feet high and 630 feet wide at the base. It was completed on October 28, 1965. The monument is known as the Gateway to the West. The architectural marvel provides a perfect vantage point to view 30 miles of the landscape from every direction. The structure was designed to withstand earthquakes and can sway 18 inches.
Oh, God.
That's crazy.
I've seen the arch a bunch of times, but I've never been inside it. Have you ever been inside?
I've never seen it.
You've never seen it?
No.
You've been
to St. Louis like once.
You've been to Michigan. Did you not drive through St. Louis?
I don't know. I can't remember.
You've seen it.
Probably.
Unless you guys went some crazy back-ass way to, when you went to Michigan, you would have seen it. You would have driven probably. Right past it.
Unless I wasn't paying attention.
If you were driving or if you were sleeping.
I was probably sleeping. I wasn't driving.
Okay.
All right. Number 7. Kansas City and St. Louis are home to more than half of the state's population.
That is not surprising.
Pretty crazy. Number 8. St. Louis offers more free major visitor attractions than any place outside of the nation's capital. These include the St. Louis Art Museum, St. Louis Zoo, Cahokia Mounds, Museum of Westward Expansion, St. Louis Science Center, Missouri History Museum, Anheuser-Busch Brewery, Grant's Farm, and a lot more.
Wow. I did not know that there was so much to do in St. Louis.
Yeah.
I've always thought Kansas City was better. Maybe we should plan a trip to St. Louis. They do have an IKEA.
Yeah, we should go there. Number 9. Anheuser-Busch Brewery in St. Louis, Missouri is the largest beer-producing plant in the nation.
That's not surprising.
Yep.
Piss water. Can you call it beer?
I can't do Busch. I used to do Bud Light, but not anymore. Number 10. St. Louis is also called the gateway to the West and home of the blues.
Mm-hmm.
Number 11. Missouri has an official state rock, the Mozarkite, adopted by the Missouri legislature on July 21st, 1967, which has to be one of my favorite rocks. I have a few of those.
I was going to say, we own a couple chunks of Mozarkite. We have a lot of rocks. We have dinosaur poop, too.
Yes. Number 12. Kansas City, Missouri is home to more than 200 fountains. The city is only behind Rome in the total number of fountains. It is also nicknamed the City of Fountains. Other nicknames of Kansas City include Heart of America and America's Creative Crossroads.
Wow. So there's a town in Ohio called Bellefontaine. But the Hicks in Ohio, no offense if you're an Ohio Hick, call it Bell Fountain.
Yeah.
It's literally, because the Ohio was settled by the French, so it's literally like Bellefontaine. That's how it's spelled, but they all say Bell Fountain.
Yeah, I've heard
that town should give its name to Kansas City, and they should pick something more American.
Yeah. Number 13, Springfield, Missouri is a renaissance city for youths. It is a good place for scholars, offering 22 colleges plus a leading God damn it, I forgot to turn my sound off. All right, my sound off's now.
Your anyways, sound off?
Yes. My sound is off now. Let's get back to it. It's a long episode.
Good God.
It is a good place for scholars, offering 22 colleges plus a leading public university in the state of Missouri. Most of the old buildings have been restored and turned into coffee shops, lofts, music venues, offices, boutiques, and restaurants.
Yeah. I mean, I knew there were a lot of colleges. I didn't realize there were 22?
Yeah.
Good God!
It's crazy.
Ugh.
Number 14. Regarded as a home of barbecue, Kansas City boasts more than 100 barbecue restaurants offering delicacies from ribs, burnt ends, and pork. The city hosts one of the greatest barbecue events, the American Royal Barbecue, from September through November.
Yes.
Activities range from barbecue competitions, vendor fairs, kids' fun days, and live music.
I do love me some Kansas City barbecue.
Yes, so good.
Yum, yum, yum.
There's a place called, I think it's called the Bronx downtown or somewhere. I tried it one time. It was really good.
Downtown KC?
Yes.
Okay.
So good. Anyways, number 15. Big Springs, Missouri is one of the largest springs in the U.S. and the world. The spring has an average flow of 470 cubic feet of water per second, or 13,000 liters.
Is this a place open to the public?
I don't know. I've never been there.
Where is this place?
It's called Big Springs, Missouri.
Okay, but where is it?
I don't know. Look it up in the map. Number 16. The University of Missouri is the first college in the world to grant a journalism degree. It opened on September 14th, 1908.
Wow.
Yeah.
Missouri State, first college to offer journalism degree?
No, the University of Missouri.
Oh, University of Missouri.
That's different. That's in Columbia.
Yes, you are correct.
Yes. Missouri State University is in Springfield.
I know.
Number 17.
I misheard you.
Number 17. The first parachute jump from a plane was also made at Jefferson Barracks, St. Louis, on March 1st, 1912.
Wow.
That's crazy. Number 18. Missouri is also known as the Cave State. It has more than 6,000 caves.
Wow. I knew there were a lot of caves. I did not know there were that many.
Yeah, and there's a lot around this area.
Yes, I know.
Yep. Number 19, the state tree is the flowering dogwood.
Aww.
And the state bird is the eastern bluebird.
Aww.
So, there's 20 facts.
What's the state flower? What's the state animal?
I'm not going to go through all that. I'm already...
Fine.
Anyways. Okay, so that's 20 facts about Missouri. Several famous people were born in Missouri. Here are a few. Eminem... born in St. Joseph, Missouri.
Which, I remember you telling me that, and I did not know that.
Yep. The AKA Marshall Bruce Mathers III.
Mm-hmm.
Born in St. Joseph on October 17th, 1972. He's 48. Mark Twain, AKA Samuel Longhorn Clemens, was born in Florida, Missouri.
Yeah. That's the most Florida-y thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. Born in Florida, Missouri, November 30th, 1835. He died on April 21st, 1910 at age 74.
Wow.
Maya Angelou was born in St. Louis, Missouri on April 4th, 1928. She died May 28th, 2014 at age 86.
Wow.
Dick Van Dyke, a.k.a. Richard Wayne Van Dyke, was born in West Plains, Missouri on December 13th, 1925. He is 95.
Wow.
He's still kicking.
Wow.
He's pretty awesome. And John Goodman was born in St. Louis on June 20th, 1952. He is 69. Fun fact, he graduated from MSU in Springfield.
Oh, wow.
And he does visit there a little bit.
Interesting.
There are so many celebrities that were born in Missouri, mostly in St. Louis, but still, I can go on and on and on. It's crazy. Like Evan Peters from American Horror Story, Harry S. Truman, John Hamm, Kate Spade, Don Johnson, Jack Dorsey, Twitter CEO, Chuck Berry, Sheryl Crow, Ellie Kemper, Kathleen Turner, Doris Roberts, the mom from Everybody Loves Raymond, and for Time Suck fans, Michael motherfucking McDonald, Triple M. It's a Time Suck reference.
Yes, you said that.
Anyways, I'll say one more, and that's it. So this queen was born and raised in East St. Louis, one of the worst areas in the U.S. Her whole story is sad and so damn amazing and inspiring at the same time. I'm talking about Josephine Baker. She went from a poor black girl born in 1906 to an amazing entertainer, actress, and singer. She thrived in Paris and other places in Europe. She tried to make it in America, but thanks to systemic racism, she could only make it so far here. She passed away in 1975 at the age of 68. I could tell you the whole story of her life, but this part is pretty long already. I encourage anyone to research her and listen to episode 159 of the podcast Time Suck. Comedian Dan Cummins goes deep into the life of Josephine. From the time she became a spy to the rise of her superstardom. She did set the bar for women of color. I brought her up because her life is and story is just so inspirational. Okay, so in episodes 1 and 2, I had my cousin as my co-host. He had too many projects going on and he had to quit this one. I mean, I get it.
Right.
That trying to do something like this while having a full-time job, and in his case, a band. That's a lot of work. You're dealing with band practice and shows and anything in between.
Yeah, and this podcast is a lot of work.
Yeah. So. But then I found a new co-host for episode 3. My beautiful wife, Ashley, offered to help me out. I could do this podcast by myself, but it wouldn't be as fun without the banter and reactions to the stories we tell.
Okay. Yeah.
So now I'm going to recap the stories from episode 1. My first story was about the Landers Theater.
Remember, that one was sad.
Yeah. I'm just going to run through the hauntings on these real quick. I don't need to go through the whole history.
Yep.
During the time of the racial segregation in the 1920s, a man was stabbed and killed in the segregated second balcony. This ghost is described as being a green orb or phosphorescent haze. It's about 5 feet tall and is seen on the second balcony and the landing between the first and second balconies. The area is said to be 20 degrees colder than the rest of the theater. The 1920 fire allegedly killed a janitor, allegedly because some say no one died in the fire. His right. Ghost is often seen in the balcony by the actors. He likes to watch them rehearse. A very tragic accident happened during the 1920 fire. A woman dropped her baby while people were running for their lives, and the baby was trampled to death. Another story is about the baby fell from the balcony, killing it. The mother was horrified.
Of course.
Yes. Either way, a baby's cries can be heard, and a mother is heard comforting the child. Performers often see an apparition of a baby falling from the balcony during the rehearsals. People in the building sense they are being followed by an unseen presence and then being tapped on the shoulder. I'm assuming scaring the shit out of them.
Yeah.
In the past, part of the fourth floor used to be apartments housing touring actors and actresses. People standing on the street in front of the theater have seen a tall apparition of a long-haired blonde man dressed in Elizabethan... I know I messed this up on the first episode. A blonde man dressed in Elizabethan era clothing looking down at them from behind a curtain on the fourth floor. If anybody's wondering, I'm reading the same notes as I used for the episode.
Interesting. Do you think it might have something to do with a Scottish play?
I don't know.
Wonder if that's ever been done there.
Possibly.
We shan't say its name.
No. Chuck Rogers, who is the resident scenic designer, co-technical director, and production director, was working in the theater in the 1990s when working late one night when he saw someone standing in the lobby. Thinking it was someone who was able to get in through the front doors, he approached the man to ask him why he was there. He just kind of stood there and stared at me, and I said, "Sir, the building's closed. I need to ask you to leave." And he just stood there. So I started walking toward him, and as I walked towards him, he turned around and walked towards the auditorium, in which case I got a little angry that somebody was in there. So I followed him, and he just stood there, and I looked at me. So I was going to go over and escort him out of the building, and he turned and walked into the auditorium, and I went right around the corner to confront him, and there was nobody there.
Oh, man.
Rogers knows how the story about the janitor came about. It stemmed from the experience he had when he saw the man in the lobby. He had invited friends to come to the theater that night after the incident, and Juan brought a Ouija board.
Ugh.
Quote, "She sat on the stairs in the auditorium and Ouija'd this experience, and what came back was that this person's name was Ned, and he used to be the janitor here in the building," he said. He says that story morphed into the one about the janitor dying in the fire. Chuck Rogers said he made up the story about the man getting stabbed on the second balcony. So is this theater truly haunted, or are people just imagining things?
Yeah. So. anything can be haunted. Missouri has had, what you said, 8,000 years worth of human history?
10,000.
There are land spirits, and sometimes I think the land spirits just like to fuck with the humans.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty wild. 12,000 years of history.
12, holy shit.
That's a lot. And my second story was about the Jesse James farm.
Oh, yes.
Of course, I did the history about Jesse Whitson James and his family farm and how he did a lot of shit.
Yes, he did.
And let's get to the hauntings. If I could find them.
Let's do, please.
All right. The farm and house have been considered haunted for over 100 years. The farm is home to many lingering spirits.
Of course.
People see lights inside and outside of the building.
So would it have been haunted in Jesse's day?
I don't know. It didn't say anything about that.
No, okay.
I mean, of course, all the burial mounds and shit around right there. Some report hearing pounding of horse hooves, muffled gunshots, and cries as the Civil War was still happening. Museum staff has reported an intense feeling of a presence inside the house. Others report hearing hushed voices and footsteps in the nearby woods on foggy days.
Ugh, I don't like woods.
Yeah. I do want to go ghost hunting, and I'm not against going into, like, some creepy-ass woods.
No. No, that's when you disappear and you never are found again.
Oh, come on.
They take you to the fairy room.
So when they investigate, no footprints or anything was found near the woods. Doors are said to slam at random. So is this farm truly haunted, or are people just imagining things?
You know, I'm not saying I believe, but yeah. I'm not saying I don't.
I'd have to experience to figure that shit out.
I'm eternally a skeptic, yeah. You know? Like, maybe there are ghosts. Maybe there aren't ghosts.
Until it happens to you. So.
Right, like, you know?
So, Andrew's story was about black-eyed kids. Yeah. A-B-E-K.
I don't like that. I don't like that at all.
There are tons of B-E-K stories all over. This type of story is hearsay. There are urban legends and paranormal stories. Supposedly, these, quote, kids are either alone or with another kid or kids. They may just stand still and not look threatening at all. But if you look closer and see their eyes, they are pitch black. Black as obsidian. Almost alien-like. There is a feeling of dread when they are near you. They will always ask for something. Maybe a ride. If you're in a vehicle, they may knock on your door and ask to be let inside. They will usually be looking down or have their hair covering their eyes. They will ask to use your phone. They may have clothes that look outdated and or even sound like they are from a different time. Maybe from the past. If you encounter these children, the lore or conspiracy is, don't let them in, no matter what. Do not let them in. Listen to your gut feeling. They are possibly aliens, or according to some demonologists, demons that roam the earth. They always want to come in to call their parents. If you let them in and make eye contact, something sinister will happen. Supposedly, the legend of the BEK originated in 1996 in posts written by a Texas reporter named Brian Bethel, where he wrote about two alleged encounters with the black-eyed children. He said that he encountered two children in Abilene, Texas, with pale skin and black eyes. And fun fact, that's where my sister lives.
Yeah. Sorry, Carrie.
In 2012, Bethel retold his story on the TV show Monsters and Mysteries in America. He then wrote an article for the Abilene Reporter News where he described his experience again. One of the stories goes like this. In the snowy town within the middle of nowhere of Vermont, an elderly couple heard the sound of three loud knocks on their door. They opened the door and saw two children, a boy and a girl. Parents will be here soon. May we come in? The children did not make eye contact and just stood there in the doorway. The elderly couple was hesitant, but after a while, they let the boy and girl inside. The kids settled on the couch while the wife made some hot cocoa and the husband asked them questions that went unanswered. The wife returned and noticed that her cat was scared and angry with the children. "May we please use the restroom?" The wife looked at the kids and she finally saw them. The children's eyes were as black as a starless universe. She directed them to the bathroom and returned to her husband, covering his face with his hands. "Did you see their eyes?" The husband then showed her his hand full of blood from a nosebleed. The power suddenly went out and the house turned as dark as the kids' eyes. The wife headed to the restroom and was confronted by the voice of the kids at the end of the hall uttering, "Our parents are here." The kids then exited the house, leaving the door wide open. The wife then noticed that there were two men at the end of the driveway. The men were very tall and slender. The wife waved but did not receive the same friendly gesture. The two men and children then drove away together in one car. The power then came back on a little later after the kids left. Throughout the week, weird things happened in the house. 3 out of 4 cats went missing, and the fourth had been found dead in the pool of its blood. The husband continued to have nosebleeds and finally went to the doctor, where he was diagnosed with a very aggressive skin cancer. Nowadays, people still claim to see the black-eyed children when driving late at night down an empty road or outside of their window late at night, or even lurking in the shadows of their room. Many have reported seeing the black-eyed children standing in the corner of their room during their episodes of sleep paralysis, or even waking up in the middle of the night because they sensed someone was watching them and the shadows were these children. So are they aliens? Are they demons? Or are they psychic vampires, aka energy vampires, vampires that drain the life force and energy from a living being?
Don't rope Colin what's-his-face into this.
Anyways,
what's his name?
No, it's what they say.
No, I know, but what's the character from What We Do in the Shadows' name? The energy vampire.
Colin
something.
Colin something. I don't know. Okay, so that brings us to episode 2. Andrew talked about the appearance of creepy dolls. Someone or some people placed lifelike dolls all around the town of Festus in Jefferson County, Missouri in 2019. They put them in weird locations and positions, such as leaning against a pole as if it were crying against the pole. One was lying in front of the license office. Some were hanging from a light pole on the main street in the middle of the town. Some were missing their heads. Festus Chief of Police Tim Lewis said in an interview about the doll leaning against the pole, "They're getting pretty good putting them where they are going to be seen. This one was at a major intersection. As you could tell, it looks like a little girl. The hands are sewn to the face, no face on it. If you were to see it from behind, it looks like a little girl. If you're out and about and you see that, it looks like a little girl crying against a pole and someone is going to stop. In this town, people are good-hearted. People are going to stop and make sure that's not a child. They're going to get hit or they're going to get run over and you're dealing with the catastrophe." So that's creepy, and this happened a few months before Halloween. It's probably pranksters trying to get a laugh.
That's creepy.
Yeah. So there's that one. So Andrew also talked about the albino farm in Springfield. And I'm going to just read from an article in our local newspaper, The News Leader. It's an article written by Steve Poken, a.k.a. The New Answer Man. Basically, people write in to him and...
Every town has one.
Yeah. It's called Poken Around because of his last name. So this article is called Answer Man. What was Albino Farm? Was there an albino? Johnny, this is one of Springfield's most cherished legends. First, there is a farm. It's north of Springfield. 70 acres is what's left of what was once a 338-acre family farm that predates the Civil War. Second, there are various tales that connect an albino to the farm. Third, my best guess, after talking to the current owner of the property, is that there were, in fact, albinos on the farm, but they weren't human. I'll explain later. For the history of the farm, I am indebted to my friend Caitlin McConnell, who writes the Ozarks Alive blog. In October 2015, Caitlin, after much research, wrote about the albino farm. The family farm was called Spring Lawn. The family that owned it prospered. The farm was known for dairy cattle, draft horses, collies, and crops. Caitlin writes that patriarch Mike Sheedy died in April 1934, and eventually three sisters, Agnes, Margaret, and Helen, were left to manage the family's considerable holdings. One story, which might or might not be true, is that the sisters hired an albino caretaker who would scare the bejesus out of young people who trespassed onto the property to drink or park. Mm. Or maybe they were there because they couldn't resist a dare. A more far-fetched tale is that there was a secret hospital on the grounds where a half-cocked scientist performed experiments on albinos. Their albino ghosts, of course, still haunt the grounds. The three sisters passed away, and the property, which included a house and various outbuildings, became uninhabited in 1979. The buildings were damaged in a 1980 arson fire when a barn was destroyed.
Aww.
Today, remnants of farm buildings rise from thick, overgrown trees and brush. To me, I imagine it looks like a walk down the main drag of Machu Picchu. I see a smattering of trash. I note more water bottles than beer cans. There's a small fire pit that looks like it has been used recently. On an old silo, someone has spray-painted the foreboding message, "Evil awaits." In the remnants of another building is the word "run," which, being a runner, I take as a call to fitness. I talked to John L. Halston, 70, whose company owns the property. He did not want me to run any of the photos I took. He did not want me to give the property's exact location. He knows people still visit his vacant property, and he does not want the story to encourage more tourists.
You should tap into that shit.
I know, but crazy. He tells me there are no immediate plans for developing the property. The stories he's heard about albinos of the human variety are myths, he tells me. My father was a local historian, and he looked into it. Yes, there were albinos, he says, but they were cattle. Albino cattle. That's my conclusion, he says.
Which would make sense why it was called the albino farm. Like, if you look at it from a logical perspective, people talking about the albino cow farm, you're going to call it the albino farm.
Yeah.
And then kids are going to hear that and think, oh my God, albinos.
Yep. So that's probably what it is, albino cattle. Makes a lot of sense.
Yep.
So that's the end of that article. I talked about an unsolved mystery from Springfield called the Springfield Three.
That's about
the three famous women. Yeah, it was on June 6, 1992, best friends Stacy McCall, Susie Streeter, and Susie's mom, Cheryl Levitt, they disappeared that night with no trace.
Uh-huh.
And it's still an ongoing thing. The cold case is that. It's not
somebody
really...
told me about a book that was written about that.
I think it's somewhere in my notes, but I'm not going to go into this one because if you want to listen to it again, you can just go to episode one. Nope.
Two.
Two. Anyways, episode two. Yeah, they disappeared, and pretty wild.
Yeah.
Let's see. Then I talked about the Bride of Phelps Grove Park, which was pretty damn cool.
Yeah.
I talked a lot about the history of the park, which is pretty cool. A lot of history about it.
Yeah.
A lot of the history around here has a lot to do with the Civil War.
Yeah.
So according to Springfield legend, a couple who had just gotten married in the park were driving away in a horse and buggy. When they were crossing the bridge, the horses got spooked and the carriage lost control and flipped over off the bridge and landed on the bride. Since the ghost is fairly recent, some say They were driving in an automobile. It lost control and flipped over off the bridge. The couple perished in the accident. The bride is seen at night under the park's third bridge, trying to search for her lost lover. She is seen holding the hem of her dress, and under her veil, where her face should be, there's only black void. One person writes about her experience. She says, "My man and I decided to go for a walk around 11:30 one night in August. We had both heard of the ghost bride and wanted to see if it was simply a hoax. We sat on the bridge and just talked for a while. All of a sudden, my boyfriend jumped up and pulled me back, saying that something had grabbed his foot. We looked down and there she was. You couldn't see her face or anything, but her white dress was lovely. It is kind of sad, really." And of course, there are skeptics. "From what I understand, the ghost bride is an optical illusion painting done under the bridge. It's hard to recognize it as anything during the day, but when you're driving by it at night, your headlights will reflect off the paint and the painting appears to be a 3D ghost. Definitely a cool trick to play on friends or anyone visiting from out of town." Which, you know, Andrew says probably not, because he's driven through there and it's some crazy people.
Yeah.
So is this park actually haunted by a faceless bride? Or is it an illusion caused by lights and paint?
Who knows?
That brings us to episode 3. This is the episode Ashley offered to be my co-host.
Yay.
I think she and I flow better. I've gotten that same feedback from several people. No offense to Andrew.
No. But, you know, when you're around someone all the time,
yeah,
you know how to interact.
Yeah. So my first story in this episode was about the Missouri State Penitentiary.
Yeah.
And
a lot
of history. Yeah, a lot of history in that.
A long chunk of my life I'll never get back.
No, that was the Tennessee.
Oh.
Yeah. This one was pretty
long. No, this is the one where we started having the issues with the audio as soon as you got to the ghost.
That was pretty wild. So here are the hauntings from that. Tales of ghostly visitors began long before the prison closed, with both prisoners and guards reporting having seen apparitions. A Hall, the prisoner's oldest building, is said to be a hotspot of unearthly activity. Inside the massive stone building are four tiers of cells with catwalks that crisscross its width. The doors of the cells are less than 5 feet high, which forced prisoners to stoop down and take a subordinate posture when leaving their cells. Early on, inmates were not allowed to look guards in the eye, an infraction that could result in punishment at the whipping post or solitary confinement.
Jeez.
Yeah. Within this building is a basement of dungeons referred to as the Hole. Here were kept death row inmates, violent and disruptive prisoners, and those suffering from mental problems. The only light in these cells came from a small slit in the door. One inmate, John B. Firebug Johnson, was housed in the dungeon for 17 years between February 26, 1883 to July 1st, 1900. Prior to his placement in the dungeon, he had attempted to escape several times and started several fires. He was moved to the basement after setting a fire that destroyed more than $500,000 worth of property and the deaths of several inmates. Amazingly, he didn't go mad, and upon his release, he wrote a book called Buried Alive for 18 Years in the Missouri Penitentiary. That's crazy.
Yeah, I would have gone insane.
Yeah. In this building, paranormal reports have included the feeling of having been touched by ghostly hands, an overwhelming smell of body odor, an apparition of a man spied on the catwalk, and movements in the darkness. Equipment often malfunctions here. Disembodied voices have been captured on recorders, and some have felt an invisible force breathing down their necks.
Ugh.
Cell 48 once housed a prisoner who was known to be a snitch. He was bludgeoned to death with a sledgehammer during the prison riot of 1854. Here people have reported having strange feelings strange heavy feelings, and an unearthly human figure has been caught on camera. Near the control room and in some of the housing units is said to lurk an entity known as Fast Jack, usually spied wearing a white lab coat and carrying a clipboard. He is thought to have been a trustee who worked in the medical facilities. At one point, a tour guide passed through the control center to secure the outer doors, only to return just a few minutes later to find all the lockers had been opened. This attic was attributed to Fast Jack. Others report him as having been seen in hallways, moving through walls, or appearing for short moments before vanishing.
No thanks.
Yeah. In the female wing, a female ghostly figure is often seen dressed in vintage clothing. Others have seen a man in an outdated prison uniform leaning against a fence. Strangely, some have seen or heard the ghosts of children, and others even a dog. Throughout the old facilities, people have heard cell door slamming, ghostly footsteps, loud banging, shadowy figures, the smell of cigarette smoke, objects being mysteriously moved around, and fast-moving entities. They also report having felt dread, a sense of sorrow, and feeling of being watched. Several major ghost hunting groups have conducted investigations at the prison over the years, recording ghostly voices and shadowy people. Here's the story of Tom Wells, who began working as one of the prison guards in 1989. He says, "They just pretty much worked a lot of the inmates like slaves. It was pretty brutal." Wells now leads some of the prison's ghost tours, and although he considers himself more of a tour guide, his own paranormal experience as a guard has made him a firm believer of what remains inside the prison's now vacant cells. "I'm the guy that lucked into the coolest part-time job in the whole wide world," Wells said, "because I'm not a ghost hunter. I just happen to be an officer that, when I worked in there, I had an experience one day." On a sunny day around 3 p.m., Wells had been talking to an inmate named John when he noticed another inmate with long blonde hair and a white t-shirt walk out a door during count. "They know they're not supposed to be outside, and I thought to myself, you son of a bitch, I'm going to jump down this guy's throat." And I go out there and there's nobody there. I thought, man, he's run around the building, so I went up to the right of the building. Nobody was there, and the big gate is there, and it's all locked, and I was like, I know I've seen this guy. So I ran to the left side, and there's a tower right there. I said, hey, has anybody ran by here? And he said, no, it's count time. It's lockdown. So I'm like, okay, and there's a van sitting there that we used to take supplies up the hill. And I thought, my God, he's in the van. We got an escape attempt. It's on a hill, so I'm looking underneath as I walk up, and I look in the back windows. The seats are all taken out, and I look in there, and there's nothing there. So I opened it up, and in the meantime, John the inmate has stepped out front and was watching me. I shut the doors, and I'm like, what? And he goes, you ain't gonna find this guy. I said, what are you talking about? He said, I saw him. I said, what did he look like? And he said, he had long blonde hair and a white t-shirt. And I'm like, yeah. He says, Wells, we ain't got nobody in this building that looks like that. And I was just like, whoa, you're right. It felt like somebody had just punched me in the chest.
Damn.
After the prison was decommissioned in 2004, Wells was asked to assist with some of the prison's ghost tours and has since begun leading the tours with his wife, who he met during his first tour of the prison, and his stepdaughter. MSP's ghost tours allow its tourists to delve a bit deeper in the personal lives of its inmates, many of whom may have been affected by the prison's more deadly and violent history, such as the 1954 riot where four inmates were killed, and it's more than 100 years of prisoner executions. During tours, which can last 2 to 8 hours beginning at sunset, visitors are welcome to bring their own ghost activity devices or use some of the equipment provided by the prison. Visitors are given insight into the prison's paranormal and unusual activities as they are guided around the upper yard into housing unit 1, dungeon cells where prisoners were kept in complete darkness, and through the basement of death row chambers in housing unit 3 until ending the tour inside the prison's gas chamber. Investigation time at each destination vary depending on how many hours are reserved for your tour. So would you take a tour through this haunted prison? Could you handle an overnight stay?
I would probably be able to handle a tour. Yeah. As long as it's not, like, disrespectful. I mean, these were human beings.
Yeah.
I just feel like ghost tours and ghost investigating and stuff, like, nowadays, it's just gotten so, like, trivialized.
Yeah. I mean, we're always obsessed with the unknown and...
Well, yeah, but, like, modern, like, ghost hunting. If you think about ghost adventures.
Yeah.
He just, like, walks into a building and he's, like, bad-mouthing at the ghosts, you know? It's just so tasteless.
That's not what ghost hunting should be. He's kind of a... I'm not going to go there, but...
Anyway, I would do a ghost tour if I knew that the person leading the tour was respectful about the fact that whether there's ghosts there or not, these were people... that lived and suffered in this building.
And my second story was about Pythian Castle. So I talked about the history of the Pythian Castle, and I'll just run down...
how it was bought for $1.
Yeah.
Stupid.
Anyways. Yeah, if you're interested in listening to that, go listen to episode 3. So, for the haunting is on that one, visitors claim to see ghosts or feel a dark aura within the castle. The Paranormal Task Force cites the castle's eloquent charm, mystic atmosphere, mysterious past, lovely hosts, and an abundance of occurring unexplainable events. As reasons this should be added to everyone's list of places to visit, to hear voices, see objects moving on their own, and see figures. The Southwest Ghost Finders also investigated the castle, and Looney said they were able to capture several electronic voice phenomena. EVP are the alleged communication by spirits through tape recorders and other electronic devices. Their results included an EVP session in which they asked in the theater, "Did you perform here?" and were answered with, "I perform here." Although the questions were asked in the past tense, most answers were in the present tense. The haunting of the castle stems back to when it served as the service club for the army complex in the 1940s. There have been many reports of unexplainable activity from those who spent time within the castle's walls during that period. Many of these reports would include hearing voices call out when no one's else is around, objects such as books in the library moving on their own, being touched by the unseen, and even seeing ghostly figures of children from time to time inside and outside of the castle. One good example of an account from that era was written by Lee Prosser and can be found on the Ghost Village website. Similar reports of unexplainable activity continued through the years. The castle was used for offices and finally vacated. The castle sat empty for some time until bought by its current owner, Tamara Finocchiaro, in 2003. Once she moved in and started to bring life back to the castle, the experiences continued and have been witnessed by Tamara, family, friends, guests, and paranormal investigators. The experiences over the years have included the full realm of textbook atypical haunting content. Such content has included visual sightings of full apparitions, disembodied voices, cold/hot spots, unexplainable smells, being touched, and things moving on their own, and a wide array of unexplainable extreme emotional feelings by many. So many paranormal investigation crews have visited the castle and had so many experiences. If you want to see this amazing haunted castle, visit their website and book a tour, and even go for a dinner and a mystery murder. Would you go to Pythian Castle, or would it make you afraidish?
I would go, for sure.
Yep, that would be fun. Ashley's story was about Kendrick House in Carthage, Missouri.
I vaguely remember.
You could just go through the hauntings.
This is the one, I believe, that has been many things throughout the last 60 years. I believe that there was a grocery store or convenience store on the lot at some point. And an ice cream parlor inside the house. I think this is that house.
I think so.
Yes. Civil War era home, of course.
As they all are.
Yes. And the family was able to survive the war and not have their house burned down by either side because they were really good blacksmiths. And they were basically double agents. They sold iron to both sides of the Civil War.
Also, isn't this this is the place that had the table, and if they used a black light to UV lights and discovered dark streaks running down the table, especially at the ends from when they did
from the amputations. Yeah. And the battlefield surgeries that happened.
That's pretty wild.
Yes. So the ghost activity at Kendrick House, one of the caretakers says one day she and her daughter were there, and her daughter was getting in the car and looked up and saw a gentleman peering out of what would have been the slave quarters pre-Civil War. There's another story of a little girl who possibly died in the house, who peeks out the second story windows at people that are out on the lawn, particularly if any children are playing out on the lawn, she will definitely want to watch them.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So anything else about the house?
Did I tell you that there was once an ice cream parlor?
Oh yeah.
Inside.
My future business.
Yeah. When I was researching what story I wanted to tell for my first episode, it was between Kendrick House and another house, and the information about the ice cream parlor at Kendrick House is what tipped the scales in its favor. Because both houses had very similar stories. They were both Civil War, survived the Civil War, oldest house in their particular area. Like, identical stories, to be perfectly honest. And the thing that was the deciding factor was the fact that Kendrick House, the property, had had such, like, a weird journey post-Civil War. Yes. I can't remember if it was a grocery store or a gas station that was out at the front of the property, like, closer to the road, obviously.
Yeah.
At one point, and then the ice cream parlor, and I was like, yeah, Paul likes ice cream.
Yeah, my favorite food. And that finally brings us to episode 4 for Missouri. My first story was about Momo the Missouri Monster.
Oh yeah, so Momo.
That was an interesting story over in Louisiana, Missouri, up by St. Louis.
There's one thing Missourians are really good at is stealing other places' names.
Yeah, like... There's Louisiana, and not far from there is Mexico, Missouri.
There's a Houston, Missouri.
There's a Texas, Missouri.
There's a Nevada, Missouri, which the locals call Nevada.
Well, they call it Nevada because there is an outlaw.
The Pinkertons were trying to find Jesse James.
Yeah.
So the story goes. Yeah. The Pinkertons were trying to find Jesse James. And they were like, we heard he was in Nevada. This is Nevada, right? And they're like, yeah, this is Nevada. Nevada's that way.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I talked about a family that saw the monster. Like I said, this is just a recap episode. If you want to hear the full stories, just re-listen to listen to the episodes. If you haven't already.
Yeah, Momo's a good one.
That's a pretty good one.
Momo is a real good one. That was,
We watched that documentary. That was something else. It's by an indie filmmaker, Seth Breedlove, called Momo the Missouri Monster. And it's like basically 1970s-esque...
So the story goes, this guy is a documentary filmmaker, and he does cryptids. I mean, this guy is a documentary filmmaker.
Yeah, that's a different guy, though, not Breedlove. his name is Lawrence. Nope.
He's the Zach Bagans senior cowboy
lookalike
fella.
My gosh.
Anywho, the movie may not have necessarily been created by this man, but this man in this movie is, I'm not going to use the word legit, but he legit has a series about cryptids and things. So they claim that he found this movie in some dusty old basement somewhere, that it had been made in the 70s and had been scrapped and never released to the public. And he found it and is releasing it to the public. But legit, it's shot on somebody's iPhone.
Yeah.
Camera. It's not bad. Like, for an amateur film, 10 out of 10.
Yes.
Thoroughly entertaining. But they're trying to pass it off as, like, legit. This is film rolls that we found in some dusty old basement.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
And I don't know if that, like, if fans of these people would immediately get that or what. Like,
I mean, the
documentary seemed to mock the residents more than anything.
Yeah. And Breedlove got a lot of shit from that, too, because I guess he's known for well-made documentaries.
Okay.
And then he made this one and then totally just
botched it.
Yeah, made it look shitty, I guess.
So he was intentionally making the people of Louisiana, Missouri look bad?
I can't say that for sure, but you know, you see spaceships flying away from the forest and...
This is true.
So...
And that's what, like, the whole time we're watching this, I'm like, this doesn't look right. They're claiming that this is from the 70s. It looks like they put a 70s filter. Oh, like, when I take pictures to post on Instagram, and I use my Prequel app, and I put the 70s filters over top.
Yeah.
That's what it looked like. But I was like, I don't know. Like, the fashion. Oh, my God. Whoever was in charge of the costumes and the set dressing fucking nailed it. I want to live on the set of this fake movie.
Yeah, and then we found out it was made in, like, 2019. Yeah, it came out in 2019.
It was the spaceships. Once it got to the part where they run outside and the spaceships are flying away, I'm like, yep, nope, that's not even...
That's CGI crap.
That's not even a New Hope remastered CGI. Yeah. Like, that's today CGI.
Yeah. Yeah, so I finally found it. It was Lyle Blackburn. He was the host of the so-called documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's the author, musician, film producer, and cryptozoologist. So...
Cryptozoologist.
If he really is or not, I'm not sure. So,
I mean, anybody that believes in Bigfoot is a cryptozoologist.
Yeah. And remember, he's the lead singer and guitarist for the Western horror punk band Ghoultown. Says well known in the U.S. and Europe, but I have never heard of him before this.
I mean, there's lots of people that are well known that we've never heard of. Every YouTube influencer ever.
Yeah, that's right.
They all think they're famous, but yeah, literally nobody knows you.
Yeah, so basically, people in Louisiana, Missouri saw a Bigfoot that they called Momo, and...
Missouri Monster.
Basically... Missouri's Bigfoot.
MOMO stands for Missouri Monster.
Yes. And then I talked about the Bubblehead family of North County.
Oh, yeah, I vaguely remember this one.
Yeah, it talks about the story of Bubblehead's...
It's like an episode of The X-Files.
Yeah, possible inbreeding, possible...
That is an episode of The X-Files.
Possible... government conspiracy type thing.
Like radiation?
Like, testing and stuff. Testing something on the family, and then just putting them out in the middle of it, nowhere
to hide.
Yeah.
That's sad.
So yeah, and apparently, if you go near there, you'll possibly see bubbleheads or ghosts of bubbleheads. I'm not sure.
Oh, so they are both cryptid and haunting.
I don't know if they're really haunting, but definitely cryptid-ish.
Well, I guess if they're people, they're not really a cryptid, but like...
And of course, if you go on the private property, you'll get fined by the sheriff, so...
Don't go on private property.
Don't do it.
And stop mowing your neighbor's lawn. You know who you are.
What?
In every fucking Facebook group I'm in, somebody's neighbor's mowing into their part of the lawn to make the neighbor's lawn look bigger.
Oh my god.
Every single Facebook, everyone's complaining about it right now. It's like, COVID what? My neighbor's mowing my lawn.
Oh my gosh. And
well, these are gardening and homesteading groups, not like Republic or Springfield groups.
Yeah. And my third story was about Zombie Road. It was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Apparently, something about a mental patient ran away and met his end on Lollaford Road after escaping from a nearby asylum. Only his bloody garments were ever found, and that's how the road got the name Zombie Road. And now he basically haunts the road. There's been photos and videos of shadow people stalking the edge of the trail. There's a documentary called Children of the Grave. So there's quite a bit of stuff about Zombie Road. A lot of history to it.
Is there any Native American history tied to it?
I don't know.
Because if there's shadow people... That could be an indication that it's not just, like, that. It's gonna sound real weird. I understand. It's some type of, not portal, but, like, between the veils.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Which, to me, would mean that there's, like, a lot of spirit activity. So, like, human activity over prolonged... periods of time. So I was just wondering if maybe there was any like evidence that Native Americans had settled in that area at any point. Not like Native American burial ground. Ooh, it's a curse.
Right. I don't know. All I know from what I read is there's just a lot of supernatural activity and a lot of I guess ghosts and
yeah. Where in the state is this road located?
Great question.
St. Louis, Kansas City, yeah. Somewhere between there.
It's in the St. Louis area.
Okay. Is it like in a rural, like St. Louis, but like how Billings is Springfield?
It's by the it's by the Merrimack River. That's all I know.
Okay, so by the river, I mean, maybe it might be more populated now. But if it's like close to a wooded area, river, that makes sense. Spirit activity is connected to running water.
Yeah, they say there's been dozens of drownings in the nearby Merrimack River.
Yeah.
And, yeah, there's the whole story.
Right.
Can be heard on episode 4.
Sorry, I'm asking too many questions. I know you don't like to be grilled.
Yeah. Anyways, yes, we went through this already, the whole story in episode 4.
But did you tell the story of the history of the road?
I did.
Okay.
Do you need a recap of the history?
No.
Okay. And Ashley's story was about the haunted castle house in Brumley, Missouri, which was
yes.
Very cool.
I enjoyed researching this one. There was actually, unlike with Kendrick House, there was actually some decent... content on YouTube of like ghost hunts and things at Brumley because the people that own it, that's kind of what they do. is they run it out as an Airbnb or a bed and breakfast, but like their whole thing, it's kitschy. We're haunted. If you're a ghost tour group, right, come stay here, kind of a thing.
Is this the one where they had several owners?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The most recent owners were the ones that were appearing in the YouTube content.
Okay. Yeah, that one had some really long, interesting history.
Yeah. Very old house. Very, as with most old houses, tragic story.
Was it from 1812 or before?
Oh, I don't remember exactly. I could probably Google it. Hold on.
I think, yeah, right here. 1812, Sir Lee is the first recorded owner of the land.
Oh, yes.
But
yes,
never
yes.
lived there.
This, yes.
And then Reverend Jacob Shaw McComb Sr. And then Dr. John L. Connor.
Mm-hmm.
John C. Martin. Clifford J. Thompson. James
this
Thompson.
This is the one that a lot of the people that owned the house were members of the United States Postal Service, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
There was like two postmasters and a...
It's crazy.
That's kind of funny. Yes, this house has had a lot of owners in its lifetime. Even into modern day, like I think the last owners, they owned it for a considerable amount of time comparatively.
This is now from 2018 to now, Steve and Judy mm-hmm. Skinner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're the ones that are in like what YouTube content there is about Brumley House. Because I think, well, the owners before them, I think, kind of embraced the haunted, like they researched a lot of the house, but to them it was like, this is our home. The new owners are like, let's kind of capitalize on this and turn it into an attraction,
right?
Because it's so haunted. Which I'm not saying that's a bad thing at all. Like, kudos to you.
Yeah. So on these stories, we'll have recap photos on social media, so everybody can see. If you already have listened to these episodes, just go back and listen if you want to. I'm sure some have. I know I did, because I had to. And definitely listen for more. I think after this episode, I'm going to have another bonus episode for Tennessee, and then we'll be back
moving
on track.
Moving on to Kentucky.
No, yeah, we'll be moving to Kentucky.
Oh. Wait, did you have something else in mind?
No.
You've been telling me Kentucky. Didn't...
Yeah, we're going to Kentucky for the next actual episode. So, anyways, there are a lot more hauntings in Missouri, for sure.
Of course.
So that wraps up episode, bonus episode for Missouri. I hope everyone liked it. So I'm sorry if this podcast isn't weekly. I could barely get two episodes out a month. I'm still working on it.
Well, we were having some massive issues with audio.
Yes, yes.
Which we finally now have.
I got these brand new mics.
Out.
Hopefully, I've been watching videos, and hopefully, I can get the right audio set for these.
So, you'll figure it out.
I'm pretty excited about that.
No pressure. That's what the beginning stage of any project is. You figure it the fuck out as you go along.
Yeah. All right, to wrap this up, if you have any stories or requests of anything you want to hear about, or if you know anyone who does, please email us at afraidishpodcast@gmail.com, Instagram and Facebook at afraidishpodcast, and Twitter at @afraid_ish. Check out my website, afraid-ishpodcast.com. All the links will be in the show notes. And as always, don't be afraid of the dark.
Be afraid-ish of what's in it.
Goodbye.
Toodles.